So we're picking up our story here in John, just after Peter has three times denied following Jesus. Verse 28. Then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So Pilate came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" "If he were not a criminal," they replied, "we would not have handed him over to you." Pilate said, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone," they objected. This took place to fulfill what Jesus had said about the kind of death he was going to die. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked, "or did others talk to you about me?" "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. "Your own people and chief priests handed you over to me. What is it you've done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." "What is truth?" retorted Pilate. With this, he went out again to the Jews gathered there and said, "I find no basis for a charge against him. But it's your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the King of the Jews?" They shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas." Now Barabbas had taken part in an uprising. This is the word of the Lord.
Lord, may your word live in us and bear much fruit to your glory. Amen. Well, today is the third, in fact, is sermon in our series called Cruciform Strength, the Kingly Hand of God, in which we're journeying with Jesus from his arrest in the garden to his resurrection appearances as presented by the fourth gospel, the gospel according to John. We began 2 weeks ago with Jesus being arrested by a detachment of police and soldiers who are led to find him by one of his own disciples, Judas, who has betrayed him. When another of his disciples, Peter, strikes out with a sword to defend Jesus, he rebukes him with the words, "Put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me?" Then last Sunday, we saw Jesus questioned in the house of the high priest about his teachings. Although, as he says, "I have spoken openly to the world." In contrast with Jesus' openness, we saw the sad collapse of Simon Peter, who denies he was ever one of Jesus' disciples. Today, the last portion of chapter 18 in John. And as in all sermons in this series, the title of today's sermon is a quote from Jesus, "You say that I'm a king." This time, the question of the kingly power of Jesus comes to the fore. The issue of kingship, of power, of authority. Jesus is asked a very dangerous question and gives a surprising answer. And we too are left at the end with an important decision to take. The scene opens very early in the morning on the next day when the Judean leadership front up with Jesus to the praetorium or palace of the Roman governor. It's very early in the morning because that's when Roman officials typically worked, early parts of the day. The colonial situation was this: behind the local power of the Judean authorities, the temple hierarchy effectively, the high priest and so forth, lay the imperial power of Rome. And at this time, this was expressed by the presence of the procurator in Jerusalem with extra troops. He would normally reside at Caesarea Maritima on the Mediterranean coast of Judea, some 100 miles to the west. But at times of increased tension, like that of the Passover, when the population of Jerusalem would grow by 3 to 4 times with the influx of visitors. He and extra troops then moved themselves to Jerusalem, and they set themselves up in the Antonia Fortress, which overlooked the temple compound, to keep things under control. And it's there that Jesus is taken. There's a glitch. Because pagan residences are unclean to them, and because the Judean hierarchy cannot eat the Passover if they're defiled, they don't go in. The irony of such particular attention to the law of God, in the very moment they're seeking to destroy the one who's come from God, is lost on them. And so the Roman procurator has to come out to meet them. It is Pontius Pilate. He has been procurator of the Roman province of Judea for some 5 years. Pilate is not a particularly sensitive man who seems to have little time for the Jewish leadership. So far, he's upset the Jewish population of Judea by bringing in offensive army standards with idolatrous markings on them into Jerusalem. And secondly, by the alleged use of sacred temple money to build an aqueduct. Pilate will eventually be removed in the year 36, when he'll be criticised for the massacre of people in Samaria. And we hear nothing of him after that. But on this day, he's to have that meeting which will make him the most well-known Roman official of all time. The meeting that will make him the most well-known Roman official of all time. More well-known than the Emperor Tiberius, whom he serves. More well-known than the great Augustus, emperor before him. Even more well-known than the famous Julius Caesar himself. Billions of people down the ages, many of whom know next to nothing about the history of Rome, will recite the words as we did this morning. Suffered under Pontius Pilate. I wonder if he ever knew it. Well, the Judean leaders have brought Jesus to him. They think Pilate will be a pushover. So when he asks them, what charges do you bring? What are you bringing against this man? Their answer is simply, if he weren't a criminal, we would not hand him over to you. Pilate is unimpressed with the, if he wasn't guilty, we wouldn't have accused him line. He is not interested. Take him yourselves and judge him by your law. But then it gets serious. They reply, but we have no right to execute anyone. They're after the death penalty. The Romans' authority in Judea have reserve the right of capital punishment only to themselves, presumably not trusting the local leadership. Although we know from elsewhere in the New Testament, there were a practice of unofficial executions, like the stoning of Stephen in Acts 7. With Jesus, however, they want it official and in the open. But we have no right to execute anyone. At this point, the author intrudes with a comment. He says, and I quote, this took place to fulfill what Jesus had said about the kind of death he was going to die. The Roman method of execution for the lower classes was public crucifixion, in which the victim is hung up on a cross until death. In Jesus' gospel, we hear Jesus a number of times saying that he'll be lifted up. Like in John 12:32, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. At this point too, the author adds, verse 33 of John 12, he said this to show the kind of death he was going to die. And I, when I am lifted up, will draw all flesh to myself. As here, the Roman death penalty was to lift someone up upon a cross until dead. This is what the leadership are asking for in the case of Jesus. And Pilate, however unenthusiastic, cannot now avoid being involved. And since he's not going to simply take their word for it, he's going to have to examine the accused himself. He puts to Jesus a dangerous question, verse 33. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you king of the Jews? That is, do you say you're king of the Jews?" I can't imagine Pilate for a minute, a second, thinking Jesus was king of anything. The accusation that Jesus has indeed made such a claim about himself is obviously something that the accusers have already said to Pilate, though we have no record of it. And that's why Jesus says back to Pilate, "Is this your question, or did they tell you?" Pilate clearly wants to be out of this, sidestep the issue. "Am I a Jew?" he says. "It was your people and your chief priests who handed you over to me. What have you done?" Now, why is it so dangerous? What is so dangerous in the accusation that Jesus had claimed to be king of the Jews, or king of the Judeans? It's the same word in Greek. What is so dangerous about that? Now, today, if someone was to make some claim like that, it would be a sign of mental instability rather than anything else. What would you think if someone claimed, "I am king of the Australians," other than King Charles III, of course. But if someone said that, what would you say? "Oh, that's nice. Really? Have you taken your medication?" But back in those days, to Pilate's mind, on his lips, the question, "Are you king of the Jews?" is full of menace and threat. To claim to be king of the Jews is to claim authority and power in opposition to the imperial power of Rome. Now, the actual title, King of the Jews or King of the Judeans, is not in what we call the Old Testament. But the last revolutionary rulers of the Jewish people, the Maccabees, 2nd century BC, had titled themselves King of the Jews, King of the Judeans. And much later, in 63 BC, the Roman Senate gave to Herod the Great the title King of the Jews in gratitude for his defeating the Parthians. So in Pilate's mind, in that world, to actually say for Jesus that he was King of the Jews is making a seditious claim, a claim for political autonomy from Rome, in effect, and claiming to set up an independent Jewish kingdom. It would be a declaration of war with the empire. Perhaps he'd been reading Daniel too much, like we have. To say such a thing would not be insanity, it would be sedition. And that's what the Judean new leadership want Pilate to believe about Jesus. Now, interestingly, there was an incident earlier in Jesus' life, his ministry north in Galilee, where he almost was put in exactly this dangerous situation by a crowd. It's in John 6, after Jesus had fed the 5,000 in the wilderness. We read in verse 14 of chapter 6, "When the people saw the sign that he had done, they began to say, 'This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world.'" Thinking of the prophet that Moses had spoken about in Deuteronomy. Verse 15, "When Jesus realized that they're about to come and take him by force to make him king," what did Jesus do? Did he welcome the recognition? Did he get ready for what they wanted? No. When Jesus realized they're about to come and take him by force to make him king, he withdrew again to the mountain by himself. He escaped that crisis. He will not be made king by force. He will not leave 5,000 wound up people in the wilderness to some revolutionary act. That would simply bring about a violent reaction by Rome, which is what would have happened. So that's what's so dangerous about the accusation that Jesus claimed to be king of the Jews. It would mean that he was a seditious and dangerous revolutionary, the kind of individual that Roman authorities would destroy in the most vicious and public way, as a warning to not even think about it, which was exactly what crucifixion was. So how will Jesus answer Pilate's question? Are you king of the Jews? Will it be with a yes? Will it be with a no? It's neither. What did Jesus answer? Verse 36. My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight, prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is from another place. My kingdom is not from this world. My kingdom is from another place. It's a two-sided answer. A kingdom, a kingship, a claim to authority and dominion. Yes, my kingdom is. But two, not as a competitor to the Roman Imperium. It's a kingdom that is not from this world. Well, what does that mean? We can grasp of something what it means by contrasting it with its opposite. What is a kingship which is from this world? Well, Jesus is quite explicit. If it were, that is, from this world, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest. But now my kingdom is from another place. That is, if Jesus' kingdom was from this world, his disciples would even now be fighting to protect him. Which is what Peter tried to do at the arrest the night before. But as we heard last week, Peter's very confused about Jesus. A from this world kingship is a kingship gained and defended by violence, as it always is, as it always is. Now, there's much more to it than this. Of course, there's much more than this. But ultimately, every form of political power in this world has ever seen is gained and defended by violence. That's what's behind it. Behind everything else. By police, by law enforcement, by defence forces. That's the nature of every kingdom from this world, though it's often hidden away. But not Jesus' kingship. His kingdom does not just deny violence, he's not just a pacifist, no. It's not the kind that needs it. His kingdom is on another level entirely. If my kingdom is not from this, if it were, my servants would fight, we'd be fighting. But now my kingdom is from another place. Now, in saying this, Jesus differentiates himself from Judas Maccabeus, king of the Jews, and from Herod the Great, king of the Jews. And although he is great David's greatest son, Jesus differentiates himself even from David, the foundational but warlike king of Israel, from whom the whole concept of Messiah comes. And even if they do share the same name, he differentiates himself from Joshua, the great leader who led the initial violent invasion of Canaan. Yes, Jesus is the Greek form of the Hebrew name Joshua, as you know. And although anachronistic to speak this way, he differentiates himself from Muhammad, who will, 600 years later, use violent conquest to enforce submission to Allah. And we might say, Jesus differentiates himself from the Crusaders, who in his name sought to liberate the Holy Land from the Muslims. My kingdom is not from this world. All this is lost on Pilate, who simply jumps on Jesus' use of the word, my kingdom. Ah, you are a king then. Gotcha. Not so fast. Although Jesus sort of gives him the point, Jesus answered, you say that I'm a king. But then he moves on and takes it a completely different way. And here's the key statement to Jesus' kingship in this passage. Jesus going on at the end of verse 37, in fact, he says, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. Or better, that could be translated, everyone who belongs to the truth listens to me. In fact, The reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to me. Wow, that is so unexpected in the whole dialogue. And yet it takes us to the heart of the Jesus as the Gospel of John presents him to us. The reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Now, when Jesus says testify to the truth, Jesus is not talking about the truth, meaning simply whatever is the case. A massive bunch of facts. That the boiling water is 100 degrees centigrade at sea level. That the sun goes around the earth and so forth. No. Nor does he mean my truth in the form of our modern self-expressive individualism. Now, the truth of which he speaks, to which he testifies, is the truth which, as he said back in John 8:40, he has heard from God. It's the truth of God. And in the Gospel of John, we learn at least three things about this truth to which he testifies. It's a truth that you gain by believing obedience to Jesus. And it's a truth that in doing so will liberate you. I'm thinking of John 8:31 to 32. Jesus in an argument, as always. He says this, quote, "To the Jews who had believed in him, Jesus said, 'If you hold my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free.' If you hold my teaching, you are really my disciples, then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." That's the truth to which he testifies. It's a truth to which Jesus can even identify himself with. In John 6, 4, chapter 14, there's a discussion about where Jesus is going and why can't the disciples go with him. And in verse 6 and 7, we read this, Jesus' words. He says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. I am the way to the Father. I am the truth of the Father. I am the life of the Father." And in the prologue to the Gospel of John, the kind of overture with which it starts, we have the testimony there of the disciples who are with Jesus. And they are writing about the Word becoming flesh and making his dwelling among them. They say, chapter 1, verse 14, "We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." The glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father. And what is that glory? Full of grace and truth. Many years ago, when I was chaplain to Sydney Uni, we held a mission to the university. And the title of that week's mission was very Johannine. We called the mission, "The Truth is a Person." The truth is a person. Justin, you can still remember that vaguely? There you are. You're just graduating at the time, I think. The truth is a person. And as Jesus says to Pilate, how you hear this truth reveals who you are. How you hear this truth reveals who you are. He ends his remarks, "Everyone who belongs to the truth hears my voice." Everyone who belongs to the truth hears my voice. Those who belong to the truth hear the voice of Jesus. How you hear tells who you are. What follows on from that shows the paradoxical way in Jesus is king, but also how little truth there is out there. First Pilate. He's now pushed by Jesus' words. He's judging Jesus, but finds that Jesus is in effect judging him. Does Pilate belong to the truth? This time I'll read verses 37 and 38. Verse 37, Jesus answered, "You say that I'm a king. In fact, this is the reason I was born and came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." Pilate asked him, "What is truth?" He has cynically sidestepped it all. He's just not interested. Something rather modern about the whole scene, I feel. The truth, Pilate, you can't handle the truth. And the sequel also shows how little truth there is there anyway. Pilate may not understand Jesus, but he knows one thing. He is no seditious revolutionary. He is no king of the Jews. So he goes out to the waiting leaders and declares his verdict. I find no basis for a charge of him. And it could have all ended there. But instead of leaving it there, Pilate makes a fateful concession. In a somewhat passive-aggressive way that he has with dealing with them, he wants them to make the actual decision to release Jesus. So he continues, but it is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the King of the Jews? That is, this innocent nutter you brought me? And then it all goes wrong. They shouted back, no, not him, Barabbas. And the author explains, now Barabbas had taken part in uprising. More literally, Barabbas was a bandit. Not him, Barabbas. Ironically, exactly the kind of person whom they'd accused Jesus of being. Now that's where I should end, because that's where the passage for this sermon ends. But without spoiling next Sunday or Good Friday, I can add on that in chapter 19, Pilate eventually gives in. He's outmaneuvered by them, actually, and hands over Jesus to be crucified. Though it's not without a kind of passive-aggressive revenge on the Jewish hierarchy. When he presents Jesus finally to the crowd, he makes a joke at their expense. We read in chapter 19, verse 14, here is your king, Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, take him away, crucify him. Shall I crucify your king? Pilate asked. We have no king but Caesar, the chief priest answered. That's terrible. They should be saying, no king but God. But they're not of the truth. They have not listened to Jesus' voice. And now they deny God himself, and they deny their own place as the people of God. They're denying the very election of Israel. We have no God, no king, but Caesar. Complete collapse. And Pilate rubs it in. When Jesus is finally crucified, there's a notice specifying the crime, was quite common, so you'd know what not to do. And in chapter 9:19, which we'll hear about on Good Friday, we read this. Pilate also had a notice written and fastened on the cross. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Well, the chief priests complained about that. No, they said, change it to this man said he was King of the Jews. Pilate dismisses them. What I've written, I've written. So, King of the Jews is the title on the cross. It was their words. What a thought. Jesus is enthroned as king, king of the Judeans, king of the Jews, by undergoing a most shameful and terrible death by crucifixion. Indeed, his kingdom is not from this world. Here, above all else, if you can believe it, he testifies to the truth. And that's the real meaning of these painful events in John 18. So I must conclude. To this very day, there is a great divide about all this. A great divide between those who think Jesus' kingship is a tragic farce and those who are convinced that despite everything, he spoke the deep truth. A tragic farce or the deep truth? A kingship? Yes, a kingship over death itself gained in the suffering of death. A kingship which is not from this world by violence, a kingdom by suffering violence, a kingdom from heaven, a kingship of truth. But a real kingship nonetheless. For the crucified one is the very one who will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead. And his kingdom will have no end. It will have no end. Everyone who belongs to the truth listens to him.